from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. News of the presidential campaign this week has been dominated by the release of a 2005 videotape of Donald Trump and Billy Bush making lewd comments about women on an Access Hollywood bus. Trump has a history of making crude comments about women: fat, pig, dog, slob, disgusting animal. So let's talk about it. What does his continued viability as a presidential candidate say about the state of sexism and misogyny in this country? What's okay in the public and political spheres? What messages are we sending to men, women, and children? All that's on tap in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. As the nation continues to discuss the leaked video of Donald Trump's quote-unquote locker room banter about women, we've brought in a few feminist thinkers to talk about sexism and misogyny in America. Is the national conversation getting better or worse? Do impressionable young men see Trump as a model for alpha male behavior or back away in horror? Let's discuss. But before I introduce the panel, I want to tell you how to join the conversation this hour. 866-733-6786. And again, I'll repeat it, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, tweet to @KQED Forum, and post on our Facebook page. And now on to our guests. We've got Michelle Goldberg, author of numerous books and a columnist for Slate.com, Michaela Angela Davis, cultural critic and owner of Mad Free, a public conversation project about image, power, and beauty, and finally Jackson Katz, author of Man Enough: Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and the Politics of Presidential Masculinity. He's also a co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention. So I thought, Michelle, that we'd have you kick us off on a question the rest of you can chime in on. What, as you see it, is the difference between sexism and misogyny?
I guess, to me, sexism is discrimination against women, and misogyny is hatred of women. And I think we've seen, you know, I don't know that they can always be completely disentangled, but I think that a lot of what we've seen directed particularly at Hillary Clinton, it's not just sexism, it's not just the idea that women are weaker than men or that they're not as capable as men, although there's certainly some of that. It's also a kind of visceral, hateful contempt, a desire to punish women who step out of bounds, you know, a feeling that women are, in one of Donald Trump's favorite words, disgusting.
Would you agree with that, Michaela?
Yes, particularly as relates to Hillary Clinton. I mean, the idea of, you know, locking her up, or at rallies you hear not just, you know, outliers calling her all kinds of names, but, you know, en masse. But it's also, this is a very complicated moment that we're in. And I think that it's not just, you know, this distrust and hate for Hillary that has been, you know, she's been dealing with this since she's been in the public life. But she's emblematic of any woman really trying to find her power and be planted there. And we have been cultured to be distrustful of women moving into these spaces, whether you were the first post woman in your neighborhood or the president. We've been cultured to resist women, women in power. But the sexism piece, particularly for, you know, women who've worked in media, this moment that Trump has sort of illuminated is something that's triggering and that we've been dealing with pretty much our whole careers. So there's multiple levels of sexism, misogyny, racism, all these intersections happening now as we're located in this campaign.
Does that all ring true for you, Jackson?
Yes. I think that was both my fellow guests were very well spoken on this point. I agree with what they've said. I mean, I think with regard to the anger and misogyny directed towards Hillary Clinton. We could talk about the specifics of Hillary Clinton, but I think that a big part of what's going on is that Hillary Clinton is seeking to ascend to the presidency, which is an incredibly important and powerful symbolic position in the sort of architecture of men's cultural dominance. The president is the not just the chief executive of the country, but he has always been, obviously it's been he, is in a sense the embodiment of the national manhood in a country that sees itself as a very masculine country, and the institution of the presidency is a very masculine institution. He's the head of the first family, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the literal representative of the United States on the world stage. And for a woman to sort of enter that space, it disrupts that whole symbolic architecture. And I think that's part of what's decentering to a lot of people, that the perception, you know, the idea that the president should be a man and what is presidential equates to what is, you know, masculine or dominantly masculine. And obviously in 2008, when Barack Obama ran, it was always, the presidency was always a contest between two or three white men, and that was just completely normative and expected. And then race became visible when Barack Obama ran in 2008, but race was always part of the conversation because, I mean, subtextually, it was always part of the package but the race that was central was whiteness, therefore unexamined and unremarked upon. And up until this election, it's been, gender has always been part of the presidency, but only when a woman runs does her gender make gender visible. But my argument is obviously that the presidency has always been about gender, but the gender is men, and therefore invisible and unremarked upon. So what Hillary Clinton is doing is disrupting that whole thing.
Thanks so much for all of those comments. I'm going to give out the number one more time, even though our phones are already beginning to blow up. 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Let's go now to Thomas in Berkeley.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I just wanted to mention earlier the guest said that sexism is discrimination against women, whereas misogyny is hatred towards women. And I'd like to point out that that's wrong, because sexism can go either direction. It can be discrimination towards men or women. And there's misogyny, which is directed towards women, and there's also misandry directed at men. So I think it's important to bring up in the conversation that sexism happens both ways. It's a two-way street. So I'd just like to point that out.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
I disagree.
Okay, jump in there.
I mean, I disagree, because I think that sexism is a problem because it reinforces an existing power dynamic, in the same way that there's no such thing, I believe, as kind of quote unquote reverse racism. You know, there certainly might be African American people who dislike and resent white people, but you know, racism is a system of power relations. And similarly, I think sexism is a system of power relations. And
so you can't be, negatively inclined towards your boss in large part because he's a man, because you're underneath
him? I think that individual women might certainly have negative inclinations towards men. I don't think that there is any kind of systemic issue of men being unable to advance in society because they are men or because of discrimination against men. I think that to me, they're just completely different phenomena. A kind of individual woman's animus towards men or resentment of men. They're just not parallel phenomenon. That's not parallel to the series of kind of systemic barriers that women face because they are women at every stage of, at every stage of their lives. I think it reduces a systemic problem to a problem of just sort of individual misbehavior or individual sin.
I think one thing we certainly have seen as a result of this conversation coming into the public domain is many, many women in particular sharing their personal stories with each other and on social media. There's something about this national conversation which feels personal for many women, because nearly, I would say, every woman has experienced something like this, has experienced harassment or abuse. Michelle, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that there was a very interesting response to the debate on Sunday, which was, you know, I watched the debate kind of, my hands were trembling. I was so worried for Hillary Clinton having to face this humiliating ordeal in which this kind of hulking man, you know, barks questions at her about her marriage and tries to blame her for her husband's affairs and puts her husband's accusers in the audience, you know, and sort of physically menaces her. I mean, it just seemed like such a like revolting humiliation that no other political candidate has had to go through. And, you know, and I'm not really a squeamish person. I'm not kind of an easily, quote unquote, triggered person. But I found I was, you know, really upset watching it. And was really impressed. I've been a critic of Hillary Clinton at certain points in her career, but I was really impressed with her poise and aplomb in handling this. And I was sort of flabbergasted afterwards when you saw all of these male pundits, not all of these, but a significant number of male pundits declare Donald Trump the winner of the debate. I mean, it was like we were seeing completely different things. And after that, you saw the polls come out, and actually the polls show that most people, but particularly most women, by really huge margins, thought that Hillary Clinton had won the debate. And, you know, I wrote a piece about how impressed I was by Hillary Clinton's performance that was, you know, shared maybe more times than anything I've ever written. I was hearing from people who were talking about, again, how physically difficult it was for them to watch Donald Trump as he lurked behind her. I mean, I think it
was
set something off
lurkage,
in a lot of female viewers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That I think maybe a lot of male viewers just, you know, through no fault of their own, they just didn't see or didn't react in the same way.
It's interesting that you mention this. I mean, for people familiar with Nate Silver, he's an American statistician who writes a very interesting blog about elections and also baseball called 538. He puts up some maps or put up some maps recently where he imagines what the electoral outcome would be for the presidential election, just looking at men voting and just looking at women voting. And it's a huge difference, you know, primarily for Trump if you're male, looking at a male outcome, all male, primarily for Clinton if you're looking at an all female outcome. And, you know, Nate isn't making this up. He's going on statistics and polls. Let's take another.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the gender gap at this point, I think, is something like 40%, which is just unprecedented.
Well, and also it is unprecedented. And also the Trump campaign has known from the earliest stages that the only way he can win really is if he wins an overwhelming majority of the white male vote. They knew they were going to lose the women's vote. They lose overwhelmingly among people of color. But the only way Republican candidates have been able to win over the past 50 years at the presidential level is to win a huge percentage of the white male vote. Trump has and his campaign have doubled down on that. And in fact, on August 31st, when Trump made a speech about immigration that was pretty angry and pretty unapologetic, a lot of the commentary in the mainstream media was about how he had failed to use this moment to broaden his base, to reach out to other constituencies than his hardcore supporters. And yet Corey Lewandowski, his former campaign manager, basically said openly that the goal of this speech was to lock in the white male base of his support. In other words, they know that what they're trying to do is appeal to white men.
You say angry white men, but, you know, white men aren't the only ones who can be misogynistic.
No, but I'm just saying the Trump campaign is all about his performance of a certain kind of aggressive white masculinity that is most appealing to white men. Of course, there are white women who are also supporting him, but there's a huge gender gap in Trump support, even among voters with no college, which is obviously a proxy for working class white voters. There's a huge gender gap. White men without a college education are something like 59%. He's winning among them by something like 59%, but white women without a college education, he's winning by something about like 12%. There's like a 47% gender gap, even among white supporters of Donald Trump. To me, this is like one of the central issues of the campaign, which is underplayed in the mainstream conversation when we talk about white resentment. It's, yes, white resentment, but white male resentment, even much more so than white female.
Well, I want to open this up back to the folks who are listening. Nicole writes, it's not the sexual discussion part that's the problem. It was the discussion of grabbing and doing things without permission or consent that that's the problem. John writes, women can be crude too, but Trump was describing and bragging about sexual assault. Men are not threatened by sexual violence from women in the same way that women are threatened by sexual violence from men. Let's take another call here. Sue in Cleveland.
Yes, thank you. I think this just emphasizes the fact that even on a local level, I was president of an association board, and the men on that board, every time a woman in a position was telling them what needed to be done, the emails, the nasty accusations just continued. And we all put up with this, whether you're in politics or just at home. And I think it needs to be in a general discussion, whether it's Donald Trump or my neighbor. If we're in power and we're telling a man what to do or suggesting what needs to be done, they don't like that. And yet I was able to accomplish more in 5 years than the men on that board did in 10.
And did you walk away from that experience, Sue, feeling like you'd had it with politics, or did it stoke your rage, your ambition to do more?
You know, I finally had had enough, and I walked away from it feeling that all that work I put in was for naught, because they're just going to do their own thing, and all the work you've put in, they're going to reverse. Hmm. And I hate the feeling that I'm a woman and a man doesn't want to take direction from me, even though he knows that I know what I'm doing. And I would never enter politics for that reason. I salute Hillary for putting up with this for 30 years.
Well, thank you for your comments, Sue. I want to keep charging through the phone lines because we have so many people who do want to talk today. Thank you again. Let's go now to Eric in Alameda.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to make a quick comment based on what Trump had said to Billy Bush in that conversation. My wife and I were speaking about it afterwards, and my wife kind of put forward that she felt like a lot of men have those type of discussions privately, and that it's like a very common thing with men. I do agree the locker talk, as they put it, happens, but usually it happens when men are very young, and it's usually braggadocious. It's not something that usually even happens necessarily, something somebody might want to happen or that kind of thing. But what I wanted to say is I've been in the military, and I consider myself to have been around a lot of, not misogyny necessarily, but certainly sexist type rhetoric, and, you know, in very gender unequal roles. And I don't think men talk like that. The way Trump was talking, I thought, was excessive beyond with the way most guys would have locker talk. That was all. That's
my comment. You've never experienced that, Eric? I don't know, in a sports locker room like Trump is intimating, or even against your will, you know?
Well, that was kind of, that was exactly what it was that we were discussing, because she was saying, my wife was saying, she thinks more guys sit around talking about how you can knock a woman out so you can take advantage of them, and how you, you know, like these kind of overly aggressive type things. And I'm like, I've never had that discussion in my life with anybody. You know,
there seems to be a question here, and I'll throw it to you, Michaela, of power, whether it's political or someone who's a celebrity or, you know, someone who is, you know, at the top rank in business. A position of power seems to perhaps stoke the kind of ego inflation that leads to a really aggressive form of sexism or misogyny.
Yeah, I think power is precisely what we're talking about. Like, that's the overarching theme. And I wanted to speak to what we were talking about earlier about how to discuss sexism and racism and that it works on both sides. That is presuming that all things are equal, right? So we can have that discussion maybe in several generations from now. But when we're talking about sexism as if we're on an equal playing field, that's when you can really say that it's happening on both sides. And also, we can't presume that white patriarchy and white supremacy does not affect women. Just because there are women that may support Trump, they are trapped in this patriarchal white supremacist construct that is being challenged right now. That's what's being shook. It's like, who's in power, how they constructed power. And there's an identity crisis happening. And what you see through this expression of Donald Trump is this existential, like, survival mode of the white male power structure. And it is being railed against with such fervor and passion because it really kind of drops the bottom out of the identity that has been constructed for the American power structure. Like, everything is kind of centered around white, heterosexual, Christian, male power. And the further you are away from that construct, the more in the margins you are. And with the Obama administration and now with a Hillary Clinton administration that's chipping away at that power structure, or whether you're Muslim or whether you're trans or whether you're anything that kind of is resistant to that power structure is what we are witnessing now. And it is, I find it I'm painfully optimistic because we are in this conversation now. It is front and center.
It's
no
out
more
in the open.
Willful.
Yeah,
there's no more willful kind of like ignorance. And the idea that a lot of men do talk like that is testimony to the fact that sexual violence and violence against women is rampant. So when we hear men say, oh, all men talk like that, that's what we really have to interrogate, is that the sexual violence against women, particularly women of color and particularly poor women, is rampant and it is not acceptable. And we need more white males like that caller who was in the military to say, no, that's not okay. We don't talk like that. And more men have to instruct men about what is sexual predator, what makes a sexual predator. The first time we heard him on the Wendy Show talk about he and his daughter having sex in common, that's so creepy. And that it is on white males to start to challenge this, because women, people of color, have carried the burden of the moral compass for so long that now this is about white male patriarchal supremacy, and it's your work to do.
I want to read a couple of comments as we're about to go into the half here. Noel writes, Trump does not feel he's done anything wrong. He can do whatever he wants because of his money and power. So it's not just a women's issue. It's a class issue about money and power. Deborah tweets, rape or fear of rape has been used to secure power forever, quote unquote, fornication under the king. We're discussing the Trump tape and its effect on the national conversation and consciousness about sexism and misogyny. And we're talking to Michelle Goldberg of Slate.com, Michaela Angela Davis of Mad Free, and Jackson Katz, author of Man Enough, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and the Politics of Presidential Masculinity. We definitely want your calls and questions in this conversation. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@KQED. Tweet to @KQED Forum. Post on our Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. We're talking about sexism, misogyny, and the political conversation we're having right now in America with Michelle Goldberg, columnist with Slate.com, Michaela Angela Davis of Mad Free, a public conversation project about image, power, and beauty, and Jackson Katz, author of Man Enough, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and the Politics of Presidential Masculinity. And we've been getting quite a few comments and questions about Hillary Clinton and her relationship to Bill Clinton. I thought it might be a good way to sort of kick off this second half hour. Pam writes, ugh, I'm voting for Hillary, but am totally offended by the guest referring to Trump's guests in the audience as Bill's affairs. One is a very likely rape victim. Trump is also accused of raping a 13-year-old. So sickening, hard to sleep this week. I can confirm, Pam, I sort of am having the same problem. Ben writes, what do your guests think about Hillary Clinton's supposed defense and covering up of sexual offenses of her husband? Michelle Goldberg, is it sexist to talk about the sexual history of Bill Clinton? I mean, regardless of whether it bolsters the impression of her as an extension of him, she did support him through an onslaught of allegations of sexual harassment and even rape.
Well, I think that, you know, so I take your listener's point that, yes, these were accusations of sexual assault, and I shouldn't have said affairs. Some of them more credible than others. I mean, I take Juanita Broderick's accusations very clearly. Kathleen Wiley, who's also accused the Clintons of having her husband murdered and having her dog murdered, I take much less seriously. But let's talk about Juanita Broderick, because I think that her allegations are the most credible. You know, she says that Bill Clinton raped her in 1978. She blamed herself. She told five people at the time that this happened, you know, friends and family members. Word got out in Arkansas and there was rumors, but she never wanted to talk about it publicly. When the Paula Jones investigation was ongoing, she initially signed an affidavit saying that Bill Clinton had not raped her. But a year later, when she was being questioned by the FBI, she said that, yes, in fact, he had raped her. And these contradictory stories were used in the 90s to discredit her. I think that it's equally credible to say that she wanted to stay out of it, but felt like she couldn't commit perjury. You know, and so I don't find that to be disqualifying. The part of the story that I find much more far-fetched is the idea that Hillary Clinton threatened her or tried to intimidate her. Now, another part of the story that was used to discredit her in the 90s was the fact that she went to a Bill Clinton fundraiser 3 weeks after the alleged assault. And, you know, again, I don't find it hard to believe that somebody would do that, particularly somebody who blamed themselves for the assault and had not quite made sense of what had happened to them. Now, she says at that fundraiser, Hillary Clinton said to her, "Thank you so much for all you do for Bill." Now, she heard that as a veiled threat. I hear that even if you believe her and take her words 100% seriously, to me, what Hillary Clinton was saying was something, was like was a banality that a political spouse would say to everybody at a fundraiser, right? "Thank you for all you do for so-and-so." I find it strains credulity to me to imagine that there was any sinister intent in those words. And particularly because everything we know about the Clintons' marriage, and there's been a lot of books written about Hillary, Bill, their relationship, suggests that he tried to hide his affairs and he tried to hide his history with women from her. Earlier this year, there was a book by a former Secret Service officer that was meant to discredit Hillary Clinton. And he talked about her being so upset when she found out about some of his relationships with women that she threw a vase at him. You know, so that used to be the kind of right wing line, was that she was a quote unquote domestic abuser. So I find that impossible to reconcile with this idea that Bill Clinton would say to her, "I raped this woman and I need you to shut her up." There's just nothing in their history that makes that sound credible to me. And so I take Juanita Broderick. I mean, I feel like I have no idea what happened with Juanita Broderick.
We can't answer these questions conclusively. You know, we just can't.
But I also don't.
Disgusting, but to bring them to a debate. I mean, whatever the case,
Michaela,
the individual cases are, to bring them to the. It was a sad, disgusting day in American politics to have those women, whether victims or as a kind of like Trump's human woman shield to discombobulate Hillary Clinton. That in itself is disgusting. You know, so what we were dealing with is another level of exploiting women in order to secure his position. And so I think that was the most egregious part of this, not so much the individual stories, that because those should be dealt with in a dignified and accurate way, right? But to bring that, to parade them to the presidential debate, that created another level of the bottom just keeps falling out of where this thing can go and how women are being used and exploited. He did not advance their voices as victims. He used them as a human shield, and it's disgusting.
We seem to be searching for the floor of the tenor of this debate.
None.
Jackson Katz, I mean, you know, you wrote a book about this, and we've been talking about Trump and also Bill Clinton, and it points up the fact that that both parties have plenty of examples of men who have said and done things that are completely unacceptable. Do you think the conversation is at least changing, like what was acceptable in the 1990s is simply no longer acceptable now?
That's a good question, but it's a complicated. I think there's a complicated answer, as with so much in this campaign, because I think, and in the work that I do, and I've been doing the central part of my work for a long, long time has been working to engage men in the struggle to end men's violence against women, and whether it's in the sports culture, or in the military, and schools, and colleges, and universities, and my colleagues and I have been working with both men and women, but specifically, the goal is to engage. One of the key goals is to engage men in challenging and interrupting other men's sexism and misogyny and other forms of abusive, you know, attitudes, not just behaviors, because the sexual assault on college campuses, for example, there's attitudes and beliefs that underpin the abuse by certain individuals, but unless you get at the attitudes and beliefs that support men's aggression towards women, you're just skimming the surface. And I think Trump's candidacy and the fact that he wasn't just booed off the stage or laughed off the stage a year ago, just based on his misogyny alone and his public record of 30 years of making incredibly sexist and misogynist comments toward women, obviously his racism and bigotry as well, but I'm just on this particular point, I'm making the point about his misogyny. He should have been just booed off the stage in his pretense to becoming the most powerful person, most powerful man, if you will, in the world with that level of misogyny as part of his record. And yet he wasn't. In other words, he made it all the way to the Republican nomination.
Why do you think more men
Michaela,
don't stand up and boo him off the stage? Why do you think more, particularly white liberal men, don't organize in the way that, say, Black Lives Matter or someone? Like, why isn't there
and along these
that
lines,
protective
Michaela,
level to challenge this patriarchy? Why don't more men? I mean, I know that there are men like you and Tim Wise, and there are people like that are feminist. But what is it that resists the white men and
men
in particular
of each other.
To challenge?
Men are fearful of each other. Men are fearful of, not just physically fearful, they're fearful of being unmanned and seeing as unmanly and seeing as being not one of the guys and losing status among their friends and their peers and the large. There's an incredible level of fear that's either conscious or unconscious that men carry, that if they're going to challenge other men's entitlement to women's bodies or their sexism more, that there's going to be a huge cost to pay, that men will have to pay a huge cost. And this isn't just, by the way, 15-year-old boys. This is adult men have this anxiety about challenging and interrupting. And I think a lot of other men's or privilege. And I think that's why one of my critiques of the way that some of the sexual assault and relationship abuse prevention work has gone over the past number of years, it's away from honest conversations about gender, honest conversations about power, and towards this more sort of depoliticized, degendered bystander intervention what I call whack-a-mole. It's a version of whack-a-mole. You see a sexual assault happen, you need to stop it. Versus, let's have honest conversations among men, as well as among women and between men and women and others, about the underlying beliefs. And I think Trump's candidacy, the success of his candidacy to get as far as the Republican nomination for president, validates in a certain way that you can be incredibly abusive and sexist and still get lots and lots of support. You can make lots of money. You can be powerful and famous and successful in spite of your misogyny. And I think that's set us back, to be honest with you, significantly in the work that we're trying to do.
Let's keep it marching.
That was really helpful. Thank you.
Let's keep it marching along and get a few more of your comments and questions in here. Nick writes, I truly feel that Trump's behavior at the most recent debate, interrupting his opponent, pacing around behind his opponent, would never have happened had his opponent been a man. It is disgusting to see that this behavior is tolerated, and it supports the double standard that is obvious in this race. Let's hit the phones now, and Rama in San Rafael.
Yeah, Hi, I actually didn't want to comment on the issue at hand exactly, but what I wanted to say is that I applaud you for having the show, and I listen to Forum and think it's a great program, but at the introduction to the show, though you put it in quotes, you called Trump's comments...
He's characterized them as locker room.
I know he's carried, yeah. But in your introduction, that's how, even though you put them in quotes, you end up reinforcing and making normative the language of saying that this was something that happens in a locker room when really he was at work. He was on his way to work. And if any normal workplace, anyone was to say anything even close to that, you would get fired from your job. And he was at work.
Yeah.
So
point taken.
Like
reinforcing
it. I don't want to equate this in any way. It's kind of like when the whole mainstream media would say partial birth abortion. It's not an okay term to use, and reinforcing it and constantly calling it that makes it normative. And so I feel like it's Forum's responsibility and great journalism responsibility, which of course you're a part of, to make sure that we don't reinforce the language that is being used that makes it somehow acceptable when it is entirely unacceptable.
Point taken. Thank you, Rama. I appreciate that. Let's go now to Catherine in Santa Clara.
Yes, good morning. My name is Catherine Sandoval, and I'm a law professor at Santa Clara University. I wanted to underscore the point that the discussion that Mr. Trump and Mr. Bean was having happened at a workplace, at an NBC workplace, that was the Access Hollywood Tour America bus. And it being workplace means that that conduct in the workplace is guided by all the workplace rules, including the prohibitions against sexual harassment, hostile environment, sexual discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This is part of why NBC is now investigating Mr. Bean, because it's also important to remember that the person who Mr. Trump was talking about was Mr. Bean's colleague and co-host who he was saying these things about, and that at the time that this happened, that Mr. Trump was also a executive producer of another NBC show, also subject to these NBC rules. So essentially, there is no locker room defense to violations of the Civil Rights Act at work. You can't just declare a mental locker room before or after, and this is why we have laws that require respectful and non-discriminatory conduct in the workplace. So I just really wanted to underscore that issue of this was not a locker room at all, and in fact, we have heard from professional athletes that this is not how they conduct themselves, because in fact, their locker rooms are part of the workplace, and that they also conduct themselves with more civility. This was a workplace, and our laws expect respectful behavior that respects the laws.
Thank you
so
much.
The locker room is not a defense.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for your comments. Dovetailing into this, Abby writes, having worked in a male-dominated field my entire professional life, I can honestly say that the explicit and implicit sexism against women is pervasive. Men are forever threatened by women with more knowledge than them. I finally left the field, but not before I had been privately and publicly bullied, threatened, and ridiculed on the job. And, I want to sort of follow up on something that our two previous callers have intimated at, Billy Bush's responsibility in this recorded conversation. This kind of, conversation can't go on unless there are men willing to listen in support, as well as hold forth, to laugh, to accept it, to not stop it. Jackson Katz, it sounds like there are a fair number of women who are who are upset at the conversation we're having, upset at what Trump has been recorded saying. But the question is, are there enough men in those private conversations willing to step up and say, stop it?
Well, that's the big question, and that's the heart of gender violence prevention work, is working within male cultures, male peer cultures, whether it's in sports culture, in the military, and just groups of guys, you know, hanging out, or in colleges and universities and high schools and in workplaces, which have their own rules, I appreciate. But the heart of the matter is getting men to start challenging and interrupting other men's sexism. And, yeah, Billy Bush played an important role in facilitating that dialogue with Donald Trump, but it also gave us a kind of a template for what we could do differently. In other words, this is a teachable moment on a grand scale, and I think this is the ultimate bystander moment. In other words, men as bystanders, if we're going to just sit passively by and either support Donald Trump, vote for him, or not vote at all, and we're giving license to, we're giving our silent consent to his abusive behavior. We're saying that a man with that level of misogyny in his heart and his record is fit to be the leader of our country. That's, in a sense, we're co-signing on his sexism and misogyny. And so I'm trying to argue that the ultimate sort of act of an empowered bystander, if you're a man, especially a white man, which is his central target audience, is to reject that by voting. Actually, the act of voting is the act of challenging and interrupting the enactment of sexism in a very powerful metaphorical way.
Well, with that, let's go now to Clint in Oklahoma.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the opportunity to call. I'd first of all like to say, in response to one of your panel members, that there are a lot of men that do stand up and say, hey, that's inappropriate. You can't talk like that. I've got a daughter, a young daughter. Anyone said anything like that to me, I would make sure that it was known. With that being said, I'm certainly not a supporter of Donald Trump. But the reason that I called, I'm not technically a millennial. I'm 37 years old. But I wanted to make a comment with regards to Hillary Clinton and some of the stuff that was said by your panelists, alluding to the fact that if you're not a supporter of Hillary Clinton, it has something to do with her being a woman. And I think I feel that that's really insulting. I think one of the main reasons that people stood up and supported Bernie Sanders is because they believed in what he was saying and that he truly felt that way. And unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people believe in what Hillary Clinton is saying, that she truly believes that herself. And I don't know if that's a problem with maybe her speaking method or what. It has nothing, I think, at all to do with her being a woman. I mean, I am proud. I've got two young children, and I would be very proud if there was a woman president. And I was very proud that there was an African-American, a young African-American president. What we're looking at are two old white people that are running for the office of president. One of them, a man, who just no one can trust. And he says horrible, horrible things. And the other one is a woman that a lot of people can't trust. And the things that she's done, the calculated things that she's done throughout her entire career to say that she didn't know. One, the president's coming out saying she's the most qualified.
Granted, Clint, let's let our panelists jump in on this. Michelle Goldberg, there are a lot of people, especially Bernie supporters, who are holding their nose this election. Does that necessarily mean that, like Clint is suggesting, that they're open to the accusation they're holding their nose because Clinton is a woman?
No, of course not. I mean, I was a very vocal opponent of Hillary Clinton in 2008 when she was running against Barack Obama. I don't think that you have to prove that you're not a sexist by supporting Hillary Clinton. And there are a lot of reasons to have reservations about Hillary Clinton. I think the whole discussion about the quote unquote Bernie bros, some Bernie supporters took that to mean that people who use that term or talked about sexism against Hillary Clinton from the left were accusing everybody who supported Bernie of discriminating against women. I don't think that that's what they were saying. I think that they were talking, and I personally was talking about a double standard in evaluating Hillary Clinton's behavior. I think people who view her as uniquely dishonest, uniquely compromised, when she has made a lot of the same, I mean, to me, she's a normal Democratic candidate, right? She's more liberal than Gore, more liberal than Kerry, more liberal on certain things than Obama and more conservative on other things than Obama. So to me, the sexism isn't saying I'm a progressive and I support the more progressive candidate. It's seeing her as uniquely compromised and uniquely dishonest and, you know, when really, and, you know, particularly I feel like you see this when you talk to people who supported Bernie Sanders and say, I've heard this, I would rather vote for Joe Biden than Hillary Clinton. That's not ideological. Mm-hmm. That's because you believe that some of that, she, you know, she's made the kind of compromises that Democrats, and particularly Democrats who came up in the 90s and the early years of the 2000s, when demographically it was a different electorate, the kind of ideological the ideological poles in our politics were very different. There was a strong sense, and in some cases, I think a correct analysis that being too far to the left was electoral suicide. And she, you know, that's the atmosphere in which Hillary Clinton has built her career. Things have really changed since then. And now there's a cost to be paid for Democrats who have compromised progressive values. But again, what I think is sexist is I think if you voted for John Kerry and you can't bring yourself to vote for Hillary Clinton, I think that that has something to do with her being a woman. If you wish you could vote for Bernie Sanders, you know, I can't blame you.
Well, with that, let's keep charging. You know, yes, Michaela.
For the folks that you were saying, if there are Bernie supporters and their hands are on their noses, their hands have got to get on the ballot lever, because your privilege can't stop you from voting, because there are poor and marginalized people whose lives will be crushed if Donald Trump is elected president. So this, at this point, to say that you're not going to vote because you don't like either candidate, if there was anyone else running against Hillary Clinton, you know, rock on. But at this point, this is where
the conversation,
particularly
has
white privilege, can be activated, particularly with progressives that are, they're posturing as progressives, but really showing their privilege. If they act as if they don't vote, the people under them will be destroyed. So if not for you, you must vote for the marginalized. You must vote for the poor, because their lives are really at stake. We're all going to suffer through it. We're going to complain. We might go to Europe. But those of us
or Canada,
what I mean? But there are people's lives in the balance in a very, very real way. So if you can't vote on your conscience, at least vote for the lesser of us.
Well, let's keep the conversation going, because we have at this point about 5 minutes left in the hour. Michael writes, we've wrestled with the politics of rape culture before, but typically on a scale which permits easier shrugging, a pro athlete, a pop star, a flailing local politician. It's incredibly revealing to see a collective national shrug in regards to Donald Trump, who remains competitive in this race. Is there any greater testament to American misogyny than a coast-to-coast willingness to slough off this behavior on so complete a scale, followed by Pete tweeting, I'm in a locker room several times a week, and all anyone talks about is Trump. Let's catch at least one more phone call in there. John from Lake County.
Thank you. I have to start out by saying, you know, I don't know. I'm living in an alternate universe. I just feel like all of this discussion is sort of moot. I feel like men and women are equal. I feel like I feel like I've grown beyond these sort of stereotypes and the sexism, misogyny, misandry, whatever. And, you know, this election is about other things. It's not about people's personal lives and their sex lives. I know we all have skeletons in our closets. We said things we regretted. They weren't recorded on a hot mic in an Access Hollywood bus going to a soap opera taping by Donald Trump and Billy Bush. You know, I think this was just, I'm considering that setting, and it's not right what he said. I don't believe that he meant that at that time or ever. But I think it's just sort of like, let's move on. Let's talk about what really matters in this election, in this country, and the economy, and trade, and our borders, and et cetera, you know. And
talk about the issues.
Right. And I just think that, and as far as the debate goes, I don't believe he was sort of pacing and sort of this, I don't know, people misread that. I just think he was exercising. He's walking around. He's thinking about what he's going to say next. I found Clinton actually sort of passive aggressive by sitting there being sort of meek and sort of waiting, like, you know, sort of showing that he's a sort of bully. It's like she was sort of presenting that side. You know what I mean? I feel like that was almost her message. Like, well, I'm just going to sit here and be quiet and meek and like let him do his thing, and people read it that way. It's like I didn't read it that way at all.
Even though, I mean, John, I'm struggling to remember a presidential debate where one of the candidates kept kind of crowding into the screenshot of the other candidate while that person was speaking. It was odd, don't you think?
Whatever. I mean, what if she did that and he sat down? You know, I don't
it,
know.
It would be odd as well, heard. Yeah. Well, so with just, that, I appreciate, yeah. John, what you're saying. I do want to sort of squeeze in a couple more comments and you know, trying to advocate for the listeners, one of whom writes, masculinity does not correlate with misogyny in an emotionally intelligent world. Another one, a Trump supporter who says, I'm a white, young, educated woman. I support Donald Trump because I believe he is tackling issues that matter, especially national security. In this day and age, I do not see sexism as something that should be the focus of this election. And now to, let's see, we're running out of time now for any further phone calls. So I'll just continue with Naomi's comment. Why can't Hillary call Trump out as the misogynist liar he is, a man would? I understand the endemic bias in our culture against an angry woman, but we should stop saying how great it was that she was so poised. She had to do that. And finally, a comment from New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, I heard not too long ago, suggesting Donald Trump talks like he's emerged from a Sands casino in Las Vegas circa 1959. It's sort of like he didn't get the memo that people don't talk like that anymore. I want to thank our guests today, Michelle Goldberg, columnist with Slate.com, Michaela Angela Davis, cultural critic and owner of Mad Free, and Jackson Katz, author of Man Enough, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and the Politics of Presidential Masculinity. Thank you so much for joining us, and continue the conversation online. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.